If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, we look on these guys with enormous sort of pity now. In a sense, you know, we think of that it was a war where we send a generation of young men into the industrial mincing machine and destroyed their psyche and destroyed them for life. And to some degree, there's nothing untruthful about that, you know. That certainly is an overview of what happened. But they themselves didn't feel that. They didn't think that was what's happening to them. So, you know, we listened to over 600 hours of veterans, from, you know, hundreds of different veterans, and there was no feeling sorry for themselves.
That was Peter Jackson talking to us about his new film on the First World War.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Opening in British cinemas tomorrow, the 16th of October, is They Shall Not Grow Old, a documentary film which takes original black and white footage from the First World War and transforms it into colour. The director is Peter Jackson, the man behind the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit trilogies, and he spoke to our website assistant Rachel Dinning a few days ago about this extraordinary film, which will also be airing on BBC One in a few weeks' time.
I suppose a good place to start would be to ask why you wanted to produce a film about the First World War.
Well, I mean, I've been interested in the First World War my entire life, but ironically, I was asked to do it. I didn't actually propose it. The Imperial War Museum invited me for a meeting about 4 years ago, and they asked me if I would be interested in doing a documentary for the centenary, and the only brief that they gave me, which was a pretty wide brief, as they said, you can be anything you want it to be, but we just want to use our film archive in a way that's sort of original and different. And I said, yeah, okay. And I said, well, what exactly? I said, we don't know, but just something that's a bit, you know, that freshens up the archive. And all I had in my head was every World War One doco I've ever seen in my life with all the same old film going through it. And I just, you know, I said, okay, well, you're just going to have to give me a bit of time to have a think about it, because right now I haven't got a clue what I could do. So I went back to New Zealand and I started to think about it. And the first thing I thought of was, you know, with all the computer technology that we have, and in New Zealand I've got a visual effects company with, you know, thousands of computers, and people would do all the visual effects for these movies. And I thought, I wonder, using all the computer firepower that we now have, how well we could restore this film. Because I don't think anyone's ever really tried. People have restored footage and stuff for TV shows and everything, but to really kind of throw a huge amount of firepower at it. So I asked the museum to send me over about 3 or 4 minutes for a test, and I'll see, well, let's have a go at looking at what we can do with restoring it. And then so we took those 3 or 4 minutes, and we spent a few months really just figuring out how to restore it, because restoration of old film is not one thing. It's, you've got to, there's about a dozen different things you've got to do. And each of the problems has to have a different solution. So you've got like the scratches you've got to get rid of. You've got the grain, so grainy film, and especially most of it's very grainy because it's been duped several times. You've got the fact that the film has shrunk over the years, so the sprocket holes are erratic and thinner. So when it's sort of put through a machine, it jumps all over the place. It's not stable. So you've got to stabilize it. You've then got to sharpen things and get rid of that. Some of it's very black, some of it's very, very white, overexposed and underexposed. Got to adjust that. And then, finally, you've got to adjust the speed, because obviously everybody's image of the First World War is Charlie Chaplin, sped up. So we wanted it all to be back at normal lifelike speed. And that was the most notable thing, because once we do all the other stuff and all the sharpening, and when you then do the speed, these people become human beings again. When you've done all the other stuff and now they suddenly move in a natural way, the same as we all move, the nuances come alive, their facial expressions come alive, and God, I was absolutely stunned, to be honest. Because I had never done this before, I'd never tried it before, and the results were so much better than what I thought
and of
that
course,
could happen.
You added colour to the film, this original
well,
film.
Well, it's sort of one thing led to the other. What was interesting is when the film was, the first restorations was happening, I was looking at it, I realised that what is the most profound thing that I'm seeing here is that we're turning these guys into human beings again. They're going from being silent movie, jerky Charlie Chaplin figures, they're actually becoming human beings. So I just suddenly thought, well, this has got to be a war about, it's a story about them. It's not actually a First World War film. It's a story about these are human beings that were in the war. And so at that point, I then asked the BBC and the Imperial War Museum to dig out all their audio interviews that they got from veterans. But I asked them to be only stuff that they'd done in the 1960s and 70s. I didn't really want audio. I didn't want the film to have audio from like ancient, 98-year-old men who can't remember much, but, give it their best shot. I wanted youngest veterans I could possibly get. And fortunately, the BBC had done their Great War series in 1963 and filmed about 200 veterans, of which only a fraction ended up in the series. So they were very kindly dug into their archives and kept looking, and they kept unearthing more and more tapes from that session and sending them down. And we ended up, with lots of interviews that had never been broadcast, never been heard. And the Imperial War Museum also found a lot of interviews that they'd conducted in the 60s and 70s. So we got these relatively young voices. I mean, the guys are only like 10 years older than I am now, really, so they're definitely not old men. I just made that the sort of my, and I thought, well, okay, these are the, it's about them, let them tell their story. And then the colour came about, the next thing was the colour, because if this is the story of these guys and how they experienced the war, it's not telling us about the strategy and tactics of the First World War. It's not, because they didn't know about that. They only, as one of the guys in the film says, their war experience was just what they could see in front of their eyes. They didn't have a clue what was going on down the road. They were not privy to any of that stuff. Their war experience was strictly what they could see and right in front of them. So I thought, well, what they could see was colour. They saw a war in colour. They certainly didn't see it in black and white. If they were colourblind, they wouldn't have been allowed to join the army. So they were definitely looking at it in colour, and they were looking at it in 3D. So I just thought, well, this has got to be colour and it's got to be 3D, because we're trying to basically, tell their story. So
I mean, I had the pleasure of watching the film this morning, and it was absolutely mesmerising. And I particularly liked that it starts off in black and white, and then it sort of opens up, and it's almost as if your eyes are opening and you're suddenly seeing through the eyes of the soldier, which is what you were going for.
Yes.
You mentioned, so we're 100 years on from the First World War. We can analyse the bigger picture of it. We know the scale of the casualties, etc. But your film looks at the war from the inside out, from the perspectives of
It's an incredibly introspective view. You're not going to learn anything about the First World War on a greater view from this film, but you'll be surprised at how the soldiers felt about the war. That's the thing that you will be surprised about.
So what do we learn about life on the front line from the soldiers' perspective? What do we learn from them?
Well, I mean, you learn a lot of things that you may or may not know. What it ultimately became about is what they ate, where they slept, what they drank. How they felt about their mates, and does certainly get into you know, what it was like to be under shellfire and what it was like to be in an attack. But you see, most of the soldiers in the First World War, you know, didn't constantly... I think there's an image that they were constantly in the trenches and they were constantly going over the top and they were constantly fighting, you know, the Germans, and that was like 4 years of that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the case. You know, they spent 3 or 4 days in the front line every 3 to 4 weeks. And when you think about it, that's what the government had to do. Otherwise, they would have turned their entire army insane if they had just left them in the trenches the whole time. I mean, it was a very pragmatic thing that it was forced upon the military authorities, is that they had to just give these guys breaks all the time because, you know, your human brain couldn't be able to cope with what was going on the front line. So, it was 4 days on the front line, and then you got rotated back into support line, reserve line, and then ultimately you got a week, you know, behind the lines, which was supposed to be a week of rest, but most of the time they made them carry stuff around, supply, they do fatigues, and they didn't really allow them to rest too much. But nonetheless, you were not in the front line. You were still just doing a job, lugging boxes. And
was there anything that really surprised you, either from the footage or from the voices of the veterans?
Yeah, it was a lack of self-pity is what surprised me. I mean, we look on these guys with enormous sort of pity now. In a sense, you know, we think of that it was a war where we send a generation of young men into the industrial grinding, mincing machine and destroyed their psyche and destroyed them for life. And to some degree, there's nothing untruthful about that. You know, that certainly is an overview of what happened. But they themselves didn't feel that. They didn't think that was what's happening to them. They, you know, we listened to over 600 hours of veterans from, hundreds of different veterans. And there was no feeling sorry for themselves. There was no you destroyed me, you destroyed my entire life. And I mean, in fact, it's the exact opposite. Most of them say it was the best thing that happened to me, or it's, I learned so much. It changed me. It made me a man. It's most of them have a positive view of their experience in the war.
I mean, there was this remarkable moment for me in the documentary when the war ends and a few of them say, I didn't know what to do with myself. I felt almost as if I'd been made redundant and felt, completely lost. That really surprised me.
And unfortunately, that turned out to be true when they went back home with the unemployment. And there was a sort of, and it sort of almost happens now, really. I think it happens in every war and every generation, is the soldiers that come back are not treated as the heroes that they should be, in a way. They just, when these guys, because we have an image of the First World War again, one of our cliched views of veterans. I mean, they're all dead now, but when they weren't dead, the whole idea was, well, these guys, old boys, never talk about the war. They never want to speak about it. And we assume they never spoke about it because it was so traumatic that they couldn't possibly even utter one word about this war, that they experienced. But actually, what they describe after coming home is they said, you couldn't talk to civilians about the war. Their eyes would glaze over. They didn't know what you'd experienced. How could you possibly even have a conversation with somebody who wasn't there? It was pointless. And and one guy says that my father, who wasn't there, was an absolute expert in the war, and he would tell me, he would disagree with things that I said that I experienced, even though he wasn't even there. And you can understand that once that happens, you just shut your mouth. And as I said, we didn't talk about it. We spoke about it themselves. So you realise, well, they didn't actually talk about it because it was so traumatic. They just didn't talk about it because what was the point? No one would understand, and so they just get on with their lives. But also, there's one quote which I do think in a weird way accurately sums up what the soldiers for the most part felt about the war, is a guy that says, it was what we felt, it was really just like one big extended Boy Scout camp with a little bit of danger thrown in just to spice it up. And that's kind of, okay, well, that's probably, in actual fact, a very good quote of what an average soldier thought of this war, which is not what we feel they experienced.
No, you sort of expect that they were almost forced into this horrific situation.
Well, they weren't forced into it. They volunteered. Conscription came in 1916, but the first, the soldiers of 1914 and 15 volunteered. And they, as one guy said, we knew it was going to be tough, and it was tough. But we couldn't complain. We just did what we were asked to do. They have a very pragmatic attitude, those guys. And I wonder if, I don't know whether people today still have it, but it was that you had to just get on with it. Complaining was not going to get you anywhere. And what was the point? And also, they were very funny. There's a lot of humour. The film shows a lot of humour. The audio has humour. And that's not unusual, because when human beings are dealing with something incredibly stressful and incredibly you know, something that's almost overwhelming, you generally resort to humour.
Yeah.
The way you survive, the way you get through it.
I wanted to ask you about the name, They Shall Not Grow Old. Mm. How did you decide on this name?
Well, the original poem is a shell grow not old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I agonised over it a little bit, you know, but I just thought, well, that doesn't sound very good for a film title. I mean, it's an accurate poem, but then we're not making a movie about the poem, we're making a movie about these guys. And I just thought, well, actually, the sentiment of that, with that little flip around of those words, They Shall Not Grow Old, actually reflects the film we're making, which they are old in the sense they're all dead now. They got old men and they died, the people that we're hearing. But the purpose of the film is to say, okay, well, let's preserve them for all time as these guys that fought in this war. Let's, you know, they shall not grow any older. It should be. You know what I mean? And it's just felt appropriate, you know, so...
Yeah, I liked the double meaning of it, referring to the guys that you see who did sadly die in youth, but also the veterans that you're hearing who may have lived long lives, but they're now preserved.
And the other thing I should say, because I think, you know, I did think about it a lot when we were making this film, and I think it's worthy of talking about, is that we can say about, you know, the attitude of these guys and the humour and the fact that the extended Boy Scout camp and all that sort of stuff, but I don't think that would be the attitude of the guys that were killed. I mean, there's a whole set of voices that we're not getting in this film, which is the guys that were terribly wounded and died and pain and painful deaths and horrific deaths, and I don't think they would have actually felt quite that same way.
Of course, yeah.
But unfortunately, we don't have their voices, you know, so they can't tell their story in that way anymore. So this is very much the story of the survivors of the war and how they viewed it, really.
Well, obviously, we're approaching the centenary of the end of the First World War, and the people who experienced the war directly are no longer with us. Mm. Do you think we're in danger of forgetting the conflict, particularly in terms of human experience, the further we get away from it?
Well, that's the thing with history, isn't it, is that history is a constantly growing thing. What you and I are doing today is going to be history tomorrow. Now, the history grows and grows and grows, and eventually, you know, things become so, you know, there's so much other history that's important to think of that the stuff that's further back becomes less important. So, you know, that's just, I mean, we don't, how much do we think about an average soldier who fought in the Battle of Hastings in 1066? We don't really think much about
it. I do quite a lot in my day-to-day job.
but you don't really think about the people. You think about data. You don't think about old Stan who was in the front row of the pikesmen or something. You know, you don't, you know, but so you do ultimately, time does actually march on and you know, it's inevitable that with time goes on that the particular intensity of the of history sort of dilutes itself a wee bit. Mm-hmm. It's still history, but it dilutes. So I think, but I still think that the First World War is, I mean, I wouldn't argue with you particularly that it's relevant today in per se, but I would say that that it's not that far away that most people in the UK and the old empire, Britain, and Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, South Africa, most of us have, we're only a great-grandfather away from someone who fought in that war. And so I think, to answer your question, I think it actually depends on how you view your forebears. You know, some people have no interest whatsoever in what their grandfather did or their great-grandfather, couldn't care less. And I don't think you're ever going to change their minds necessarily. They just live for today and for tomorrow. But I think sometimes, especially as you get older, I found that when I got to be in my 40s, and you know, I just felt, even though I've always been interested in the First World War, I just felt a sudden surge of interest in my ancestors, not just the First World War, but I did lots of research. Where did my great-grandma come from and what in her mother used? Suddenly as you get older, you get more interested in it, you know, so it's certainly hard to get young people interested in the old members of their family, or it's very hard. Because they're young, they are living for today, and they've got their whole lives in front of them, and they've got other things to think about. But you get to a certain age, and you do suddenly, you know, and when you face your own end, I suppose, and your mortality, you start to think, well, where am I in the great progression of our family, and what happened earlier? But certainly, you know, the First World War is not that far away. It's a pretty immediate. Most families will probably have photos of members, you know, the family, great uncles, grandfathers in uniform in the First World War. You probably go into the cupboard or your shelf and dig out an old family photo album, and you'll see them. So, you know, that's not It's still there. It's still part of your family.
Well, you dedicated the film to your grandfather. Mm. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he died in 1940, so I never met him. Unfortunately, I would have loved to have done, but, you know, especially as time has gone on, I certainly would have. But I kind of like doing this movie I tried to make it a common experience of a soldier. You know, I didn't really do stories that I thought were individual, only this guy experienced this particular thing. I sort of tried to tell the story that everyone was talking about, so it was a sort of a very collective. So I did actually feel all the way through the making of the film that I was sort of feeling a lot of what my grandfather would have, you know, I was learning a lot about what my grandfather would have lived through. Like, you know, the guys that talk about their lunch and their breakfast and their meals and what they ate, well, my grandfather probably ate the same stuff because the British Army was pretty consistent. It didn't have a lot of variety. So, so I was really, when I was listening to guys talking about that stuff, I was learning and understanding what my grandfather ate. So I appreciated it. I mean, I like that. I did, even though he's not in the film and there's no recordings of him or anything else, I did feel quite, I did feel like I was understanding a lot more about his experience in the war.
And you do—you particularly have an interest in the First World War. I think you have seven planes, do you?
I've got 50 or 60 planes, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. What's your interest in the First World War as a topic in particular?
Well, I grew up with my dad telling me stories about his father, my grandfather, you know, in the South Wales borders. And my dad used to buy, you know, in the 60s when I grew up, there wasn't these great industry of First World War books that there is today. You know, like, there seems to be books every day coming out about different topics. But in the 60s, there was not a lot was being written about the First World War. But every now and again, a book would come out and my dad would go and buy it. And so the bookshelf at home when I was a kid was sort of slowly growing up with books. And I was an only child, so, you know, I'd certainly had time to, you know, we didn't have a big bookshelf either. We were in a very small house with not much. And so I just would pull books off the bookshelf and look, read First World War books, and my dad would tell me stories that he knew from his father. And it was just something I grew up with, and growing up with it, I haven't lost my interest in it, really. And ironically, my interest sort of veered into different directions away from my grandfather. I became interested in the aviation in the air war, which he wasn't part of. No part of my family. I don't think any of my family were in the Royal Flying Corps, but I sort of became interested in the air war and started collecting aircraft. I started building models first, Airfix models, long before I started, was able to build planes. But now, when I was able to build planes, I started building them, and I haven't stopped building them. And then I started to become interested in the Gallipoli Anzac story because, you know, I was in New Zealand, and even though my grandfather was in the British Army, you know, when I was young, I didn't quite understand it all, and Gallipoli was a thing in New Zealand, and my grandfather fought there, and I couldn't kind of figure out how and why New Zealand, we used to go out and march on Anzac Day on the 25th of April for the Gallipoli landings, and my granddad was there, but he was in the British Army, and it took me a long time when I was 7 or 8 years old to figure it all out, you know, so in a way, the Anzac story of Gallipoli, you know, has become something I'm really interested in, you know, and my grandfather was actually there, but I've sort of been interested in the Anzac part of that because of the country that I'm in. And ironically, I'll tell you one story that I haven't really told many times. One thing that was quite remarkable is that, my dad immigrated to New Zealand at the end of World War II. He was a British soldier in World War II, and like a lot of people, they left Britain to go find a new life after the war. My mum did the same as well, and they both of them met in New Zealand. They didn't know each other here. They were both English, and one time I remember asking my dad, I said, well, why when you left England at the end of World War II, why did you come here to New Zealand? I mean, you could have chosen Canada, you could have chosen Australia, South Africa. Lots of British servicemen went all over the world, you know, when they went to find a new life. And because you came to New Zealand and you met my mum and, you know, ended up with me. And he said to me, he chose New Zealanders, which he'd never been to in his life before. He came to New Zealand at the end of the Second World War because his father had admired the way the New Zealand soldiers fought in the First World War, that the 2nd Battalion South Wales Borderers had fought alongside the Kiwis on several occasions.
Wow.
They had it at Gallipoli, they did it at Passchendaele, and they did it at Lakanwar at the end of the war. So they had fought side by side with the Kiwis several times. And he said that his father, used to always tell him how great the Kiwi troops were, and he would describe the New Zealanders that he met, and he really admired them. My grandfather really admired the Kiwis. So when Dad had to immigrate, he chose a country that his father had spoken a lot about, and you know, he came over to New Zealand. He met my mum and me. So if in a funny way, I am a child of the First World War, that if my grandfather hadn't admired the Kiwi troops, if he admired the Canadians more or the Australians more, then that's where Dad would have gone, and he wouldn't have met my mum. So, you know, it's kind of a strange, weird little thing.
That was Peter Jackson.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
After speaking with Peter, Rachel caught up with Jenny Waldman, director of 14 to 18 Now, and Diane Lees, director general of the Imperial War Museum, both of whom were also involved in the film project.
So I want to start with asking you both about Peter Jackson's new film, They Shall Not Grow Old. So what do you think this film adds to our understanding of the war?
Well, I think that what Peter Jackson has done is he's brought his incredible storytelling ability and also his film digital technology understanding to an amazing story and an incredible archive. So the combination of the two means that the archive will be opened up, I think, to a new generation, a generation that perhaps isn't so used to watching black and white movies anymore, isn't so used to sitting and watching scratchy black and white movies that have fantastic stuff in them, but actually need a little bit more effort to see. And what he's done is he's given the war humanity. He's telling the war story from the men's point of view, and I think that hasn't been done before. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think one of the really the jobs of the museum is to make its collections as accessible as possible. And the partnership in the film with 1418 Now has and the museum and Peter has been about bringing a contemporary audience that perhaps aren't traditional museum visitors, both to the museum in terms of the subject, but also to achieving a greater level of knowledge in the general population about the history of the First World War and how important it is to understand the First World War in order to understand what's happening in the world today. So we see it as a kind of culmination of the work that we've been doing as a kind of group of organisations.
I mean, perhaps you can tell me a bit about the footage that was used. It's been in this archive for a while. Who are the people who recorded the footage is kind of what I want to know.
Well, it's really interesting because the footage is largely, if you look at the beginning of the war in 1914, it was really a traditional reporting. So you got a journalist who wrote a column, you know, and then they employed artists to represent the battle scene. So that's how they were taking the war news home. And then, you know, with the ingenuity of the French and inventing much more portable cameras, there started to be an idea that you could record the kind of, you know, the battlefield on film. And so what we see is the beginning of the documentary. What we see, you know, with the Battle of the Somme film in 1916, we see a whole piece of propaganda. It was largely for the home front audience. It was about how gloriously we were building up to, at the point of time, win the Battle of the Somme, which we know wasn't the case in hindsight. But what film and that technology did was it introduced, you know, sort of bringing the battlefield into the cinemas. And it actually made cinema going for the first time actually acceptable to the middle classes because they were going to see if they could see their relatives in the film.
One of the things that I was struck, because I watched the film this morning, was obviously some of this film was produced for propaganda type purposes, but there's actually some quite graphic images in the film of death. And were these the kind of things that they were bringing home to audiences at the time? Because I can't imagine that they were.
There's a definite difference. So if you look at the Battle of the Somme, which was supposedly about, you know, us winning the war, It's very much, there's a very light touch. And of course, prior to using film as a method, actually you only showed the dead of your enemy. You didn't show your own dead. So once filming came in and they were mixed bodies, so they were British and German, etc., it started to change the nature of the way in which information was shown at home. And in fact, I think there was a recognition that actually telling the public, I mean, they knew people weren't coming home and they'd seen people coming home injured. So to then cleanse the reporting that was coming back from the front would not have been good propaganda. So you start to see, if you look at even the differences over 6 months of the battles of the Somme, you start to see a different kind of journalistic quality. You start to see a little bit more kind of, you know, reality and some beautiful cinematic qualities coming into the films that come back as part of the narrative. But it was a very different purpose. There's a different purpose between the propaganda leading up to people supporting the war and actually reporting the war. And that's, I think, 1916 was probably the tipping point when those two methods kind of started to diverge into the kind of war reporting that we would expect to see today.
And we do see that in the film. We see a shift from some of these propaganda type images into absolutely. The more sort of graphic, the true horror.
Yeah, absolutely.
You both sort of mentioned that you want to target young people as part of the film's release. Do you think we do enough in schools to remember the First World War? If we start with...
Well, I think the First World War is still taught in schools. Kids learn the history and also the poetry of it, much the same, I think, as I did when I was at school. And I think that one of the things that I've learned through working with at 1418 now and with the IWM and on the centenary generally is that through our artist commissions at 1418 now, we've invited artists to look at a number of different perspectives, particularly, for instance, a global perspective on the First World War. And it has been quite remarkable to me that many of those narratives are not taught in school. So we don't learn about the war in Africa. We don't learn about the million people in Africa killed during the First World War. We don't learn so much about the contribution of the Indian subcontinent and of the Chinese labor corps and so on. So the surprise, I think, for me is that our education is still mainly focused on the Western Front. And Peter's film is indeed entirely focused on the Western Front because that's where the film was made, and he's worked entirely with archive resource. So he has been constrained by archive resource, but in every other way, he's broken free of all of those boundaries. And I think that the film will help schools as a resource simply because it genuinely brings the whole thing alive. It absolutely feels as if you're there in the trenches with the men. To be able to see their faces, to be able to hear in the background what they're saying to each other, the splashes of the tanks, all of those things just kind of make you really sit up and listen and watch it and take it all in and feel as if you're beginning to understand what life might have been like then.
Mm-hmm. So we're approaching the centenary of the end of the First World War, and over the past 4 years you've both spearheaded this huge drive to commemorate the war. So what were your aims back in 2014 when you set out on this huge undertaking?
Well, I remember sitting with Di and various other members of our 1418 Now board just before we launched our first season. And one of you, I don't know, Di, whether it was you or one of the other board members, said one of the questions you're going to be asked is how many people you are going to reach with your 1418 Now programme of arts commissions. So we had a little think and thought, OK, let's be hugely ambitious about this. We've got 5 years. We're going to reach 10 million people. And we've so far reached 35 million people.
Wow.
So one of the things that has really come through to me is quite how fascinated people are in this country about the First World War. And also, you know, how many different stories there are to tell. Each of our artists has found different ways into it, different sources of inspiration. Many of them have had the great privilege of being able to come to the IWM, talk to historians, delve into the archives, find new things to talk about. And audiences are really, really interested.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the most remarkable things that have cropped up from the past 4 years for you both?
Oh, there's so many. There are so many because actually one of our ambitions, of course, was to make sure that people understood their own history, so their own family history. And some of the stories that the families tell of, you know, sort of they never asked their grandparents anything about the war, or grandpa never talked about the war. And they have found the most extraordinary things, and some of them really tragic, like people who were shot at dawn, people who came back from the war and you never would have known they'd served, and people who had a very different history. So I think one of the great things about this project is that it's brought people, A, that aren't traditional museum visitors in, but it's also then given them a reason to connect, and that reason is now personal. So one of the extraordinary things about the poppies at the tower was that actually now we see people where the poppies have been and taught, bringing their poppies like a pilgrimage. And that's a really important emotional connection. And we think the long-lasting legacy of the First World War centenary is because we've reconnected so many families with their own history, as well as the big narrative and the big stats and the big figures that we would always do.
Well, I was going to ask, actually, because there's a danger the further you get away from the conflict, it can become a bit impersonal.
Yeah.
So, and as you just said, this is now the legacy going forward.
Absolutely. So Lives of the First World War, which is one of our digital projects, now has the recorded lives of 7.5 million people that served in the First World War, even on the home from the home front. But the conscientious objectors, everybody, and the public are crowdsourcing. And we have a whole series of community groups that have been doing their village history, etc. So we think this is not something that will just disappear back. It might over time, but, you know, we think that post the First World War centenary, there are still lots of people who are still doing their family history and still having those conversations. And that intergenerational messaging is what creates the kind of museum visitors of the future.
It's interesting you say that, Di, because we just launched our final project with Danny Boyle for the Armistice last week. And Danny was asked this very question about whether his project on beaches where we're saying thank you and farewell is marking the end of remembrance, really, of the First World War, as well as the end of the First World War centenary. And his answer was fascinating. He said, when he started the project, when we invited him to think of something to do for the Armistice 100 years later, he thought that it would be the final farewell. He thought that after 100 years, when the First World War was just tipping over the edge of the kind of human link to your grandfather or your grandmother, that actually it was time to stop and time to say that final farewell. And then he said, but I've changed my mind. And now that I've made an emotional connection, I realise that that would be quite wrong, and that actually I think we should continue.
And that's the other thing about Peter and the film, is that his personal family connection to the First World War is kind of, you know, resonates by the sensitive way in which he treats the material. He has a personal connection to the First World War. He has a passion for the First World War history. And the way he treats that human narrative really comes through in the film, that he really cares about the experience and the subject. It's not just another project, and it's quite techie, and it has that human heartbeat all the way through it, and that's really strong.
It is quite an interesting one, because obviously we know all the big statistics. We can look at the war through these big statistics and from step back almost, and often that is how we look at the war, as historians look at the war. But Peter's film, I was struck this morning by just, it is completely a personal, it's so personal. It's the voices of people who were there and the images of people who were there. Yeah. There's no one in it that's sitting back and analysing it. It's just this raw
thing. It's so powerful. Sorry, Jenna.
I think that he does exactly what the artists of the First World War did. So the men who served, who then created the poetry and the paintings that have influenced our perceptions of the First World War so strongly over the last 100 years, were right there. And they gave their emotional, personal, human response to the actuality of the First World War. And I think that's exactly what Peter does all over again. And he brings extraordinary technology and the sort of techie side of things to it. But the fundamental thing is that he is really engaging us again with it.
Yeah, real passion for the subject.
I think one final question. We've touched on it already, and I know what your answer is going to be, but has the past 4 years of centenary commemorations been a success, and do we have a lasting legacy?
Well, yes, we think so. I mean, it's been a success partly in terms of the kind of public interest and engagement, which I think has been seen across the board, whether it's at the museum or other heritage centres, in the arts commissions, in television documentaries, book sales, everything about the First World War has had no let up in public interest. But also, I think one of the things that we've been able to do is reconnect emotionally through the arts commissions with those stories and narratives of the First World War that give a personal connection. And I think that that will be part of the legacy. The artworks themselves, Peter's film, which is going to every secondary school in the country, is going to be a legacy itself. It will be at the Imperial War Museum forevermore, as will the two poppies sculptures, Wave and Weeping Window, will be part of the Imperial War Museum's collection. So all of those things are, indeed, the 1418 Now archive is going to be rest within the IWM for you. All of these things for the centenary will be part of the story of the First World War. And I think in 50 or 100 years' time, people will look back just not just at the First World War, but also what happened 50 years later and what happened 100 years later, and how we brought our modern sensibilities, our contemporary sensibilities, to that centenary. And it will be very different in another 100 years' time.
It will. And I think the other thing to say is that I think the expectation was relatively low, but actually, you know, the facts that people know now. So there were people when we originally surveyed in 2013 that didn't know that the First World War was 1914-18. They didn't know that there was rationing in the First World War. They thought that was the Second World War. There was a lot of confusion between the Second World War narrative and the First World War narrative. And we've been surveying people right the way through the process. So the level of public understanding of the big narrative, as well as those personal experiences, we can prove has actually been a success. So there's lots of evaluation coming up where we'll make sure that the part of the legacy is showing the impact that it's had on both individuals and organisations and community groups. So the First World War Centenary Partnership, which is led by IWM, has had over 4,000 partners in 62 countries during the 4 years. So it's a global impact as well as a local impact, and that's exactly what we set out to do.
And one, I know I said that was my final question, but one final question. What can you describe to me a story that you've come across in this past 4 years that's really moved you from the war?
Well, one of the stories that I didn't know of the First World War that I find astonishing is of the Dazzle Ships, is of the artists who were commissioned within the First World War set up within the Royal Navy to find solutions to a problem, which is that Navy and Merchant Navy ships were being torpedoed, and created a whole system of dazzle design of ships that has actually influenced modern art for, you know, many decades, and actually influences fashion now. If you look at, you know, most fashion seasons, there'll be quite a lot of dazzle within, you know, one Topshop or Henny's or somewhere. And that all came from the First World War. And the dazzle ships of the First World War, which were, thousands of them were painted in the UK. And then Norman Wilkinson, the artist who had invented dazzle, went over to the United States and dazzled 1,250 ships in America.
What do you mean
literally
by dazzled?
Huge ships.
They're like a geometric pattern.
Okay, let's find some pictures.
So instead of what you would imagine is typical camouflage, they are a very kind of modernist set of geometric patterns. And the whole idea is that if you popped up with your telescope from your submarine and you were tracking a ship, that the disruptive pattern would the submarines wouldn't be able to judge the speed or the direction of the ship.
Wow.
So that was the whole idea behind them. Unfortunately, I hate to say this to Jenny, is that it was never proven that it was successful. Because we also invented the convoy system, which is so synonymous with the Second World War, where we put destroyers around merchant ships in order to protect them from the submarines. But it was a fabulous idea. And in fact, you know, if you look at the way in which, you know, new camouflage has been designed for disruptive patterning, it's very dazzle oriented. So it's an incredible story.
That's incredible. I've never heard of that before. I'm going to have to track down some images to accompany the piece that we'll do on this.
And probably my favourite story is a personal one, actually. Well, not personal to me, but personal to the museum, which is the story of Lottie Mead. And Lottie was a mum of three, and she worked in the shell filling factories, the national shell filling factories, and she became what they called a canary girl. So her skin became tainted by the yellow sulfur, and so she. But unfortunately, she died of poisoning. And when her when the museum was created in 1917, there was an appeal in the ration book for material, and her husband sent the only two photographs that he had of Lottie, and asked for the museum to select one and send the other one back because he wanted her to be seen alongside her comrades forevermore, and so became part of the first photographic collection that was the founding collection of the museum. So Lottie, to me, kind of evokes that home front service, that complete sacrifice, but also the pride in the family that she became part of the national story at that point. And that, to me, kind of confirms the purpose of the museum going forward, which is to keep those personal stories alive.
Well, thank you both for your time today. It was really nice speaking to you. Where should I send our readers if they want to learn more about what you do?
There are two websites.
Two websites.
One is 1418now1418now.org.uk.
The IWM is iwm.org.uk. And if you're interested in community events and partnerships, then it's 1914.org. So there's two there. And of course, the museum has five branches and they're always open.
That was Jenny Waldman and Diane Lees. And as I mentioned at the start, They Shall Not Grow Old is due to be released in UK cinemas tomorrow, the 16th of October, and will air on BBC One around the Armistice centenary. And that is about all for today, but we will be back on Thursday to discuss Churchill with Andrew Roberts.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast. Thank you.